From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. What makes people gay? Reporter Neil Swidey asked leading researchers that question 10 years ago when people were talking about a gay gene. It's been a big decade since then for LGBT Americans. Now the talk is of fluidity in sexual orientation. The scientists are still at their work, and Swidey is out with a new report on the latest understanding. This hour on Point, what makes people gay? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question, your observation on the origins of sexual orientation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Hyannis, Massachusetts, is Boston Globe staff writer Neil Swidey. His big piece in this Sunday's Boston Globe magazine was headlined, What Makes People Gay? An Update. Neil Swidey, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
You write that this was one of the most read stories ever in the Boston Globe online, and that people have just kept coming back and reading and reading and reading it years after you first published it a decade ago. How do you interpret the origin, the source of that deep and ongoing interest?
You know, it's fascinating. I would have never expected a story that was so heavy with science to be such a well-read piece. But I think people are innately curious about this, and what I would find is over the years, new readers coming to it for the first time, almost every month I would get an email from someone, often adolescents or their parents, sort of dealing with these issues and kind of urgently Googling it and coming up with this story and going into this deep dive and then asking what's changed. And for 10 years, I really didn't have answers for them, so I decided to go back.
It's been an amazing year on the gay and lesbian LGBT front. I mean, just gay marriage for huge starters. Public opinion has changed in many ways. Certainly policy has changed in this country. What about the science? Have there been major advances in these 10 years in the scientific understanding of what makes people gay?
Well, I think you hit it head on there. When I came into this 10 years later, again, it's an unusual perspective to go so deep and then not touch it for 10 years. I expected the science to keep pace with the profound changes and leaps in public policy. You know, 10 years ago, Massachusetts was this outlier in the nation with gay marriage.
First legalized
gay marriage, and now this year the conservative Supreme Court makes gay marriage the law of the land here. No one really predicted that was going to happen that fast. The science has not made those giant leaps. Unfortunately, the science, because these tend to be small, poorly funded research areas, those leaps haven't been as profound. But then again, it's probably impossible to kind of match those giant leaps in public policy and acceptance. Having said that, though, what I did find were several areas where there has been real progress and this accretion of research, all pointing kind of to this direction of sexual orientation being inborn, at least in males, and that in utero, a prenatal launch pad being really where the decisive action seems to be happening. But as you referred to, there are other important issues around that, including this idea of fluidity.
We're going to talk with a couple of the scientists who are right at the heart of this research before this hour is out. Let's just go to the very big kind of nature-nurture question first. Now, you just said that it points to inborn, especially in males. There's a gender difference when it comes to sexual orientation being stamped. How and when that happens?
Yes, and I think that there's two reasons for that. And again, that's not completely settled, but there has been for some time an appreciation that orientation may be set differently in males versus females, just the biology of how things are happening and how the sex differentiation of the brain is happening and other things. That is one area. Another area, which is more a kind of cautionary piece of this, is that detecting orientation in females is just harder than it is in males. Basically, orientation is arousal in males, and there are very straightforward ways of detecting that. With females, the researchers have had more difficulty trying to discern what they're actually detecting. So I think that for those two reasons, one, an understanding that there is a different mechanism likely, or at least a different variation of it, and two, just the science is a little farther behind for females.
Female arousal, more subtle, maybe a little more difficult to track, so it's not as straightforward. Can we just go back for a second? 10 years ago, people were still talking about a gay gene. This came up in the 1990s, and I think it was still kind of on the radar when you wrote your last piece. What was the gay gene push? What had people found, and what was the hope or expectation there? How's that working out, this sort of genetic explanation?
Yeah, absolutely. That was originally, when I started this 10 years ago, it was looking for this gay gene, because in the mid-90s, or in the early 90s, really, there was a researcher named Dean Hamer who came out with this sort of bombshell of saying that there were these linkage areas on in males, looking at male brothers and seeing that that there were these markers that there were similar, and pointing out that was suggestive that there might be some kind of gay gene. Now, one of the things that I found early on and has certainly gotten only clearer is that there was never going to be a single gay gene. You know, there are about 150, if not several hundred, genes that are believed to influence something as straightforward as human height. And that's even before it interacts with diet and other kind of environmental factors. So something as complex as sexual orientation is probably going to be influenced by at least as many genes. So there was never going to be a single gay gene. And I think, but what there has been now, 10 years later, when I was writing about it a decade ago, they were just starting this NIH large study that was supposed to get some answers on that. And they did. They got some answers that showed a stronger result or suspicion of the genetic role, but a smaller role, probably only about 30% maybe of the orientation might have the genetic influence.
So I want to look at this, what you call the prenatal launch pad, the environment of the womb as being very important here. Can we just step back for a second and think about, there's been so much talk about gay rights and gay identity, LGBT. What percentage of the population is gay, lesbian?
You know, it's a fascinating question because I think most people sort of assume that, you know, this whole idea of 1 in 10. I mean, I think this came through in the 70s and 80s. It was sort of pushed pretty aggressively by the gay community. And the data never really supported that. That came from kind of Kinsey reports, and it was sort of misinterpreted in that way. The most reputable studies over time show that about 3.5%, somewhere in the 3 to 5% range of Americans looking at this, or Westerners, are gay, lesbian, or bisexual. So that's a much smaller figure than what people have traditionally believed. Having said that, there's a much greater appreciation now of that there's range and that there's a continuum in there, which goes back to the Kinsey scale, which the sex researcher Alfred Kinsey had pushed forward in the late 40s, that there is some kind of range of people in terms of their attraction on there. But in terms of the primary attraction that people have, it's a smaller number than people might assume.
Kinsey scale had this numerical range 0 to 6, as you remind us, 0 being just entirely heterosexual, 6 being at the other end of that spectrum. Fluidity is a big word here now, 10 years after your first report, and we will look at that. Talk about the womb and what goes on there and what has been learned about how that time in the womb might affect sexual orientation.
Well, there's lots of important things that are happening in the womb. I think, you know, as parents, you sort of look at that as this black box, you know, those 9 months where you go for your ultrasound appointments and just hope for kind of reassuring nods from the ultrasound tech.
And also that it's sort of a done deal at that point. You want nutrition and you want to, like, you know, not be too fraught or but you sort of think that what's cooking in there is the recipe is already done.
Right, exactly. But there's lots that's happening on there. And, you know, one of the things I looked at 10 years ago and then again this time was, you know, identical twins are this great kind of prism for looking at this research because, you know, they have their genetic clones and then they're raised often in very similar circumstances. But they have different prenatal periods, you know, that often, you know, they're...
What do you mean by that? They're in the same womb?
They're in the same womb, but often they have different experiences. They're in different positions in the wombs. Different things happen in different sequences. And often, even just looking at birth weights, there are, you know, sometimes significant differences in the birth weight of identical twins coming out. So something may be happening on there. And, you know, one of the things that researchers have looked at for some time is sort of the role of hormones in that prenatal period. You know, the default female brain, if you will, and the masculinizing process for someone to become male. Things are happening in there, and I think there's some interesting pockets of research that we can certainly talk about that look at what might be happening in a different way during that period.
Does that suggest that it depends on the life experience during pregnancy of the mother? Or
there's not a connection. Nothing the mother is doing is really affecting this at all. And there shouldn't, you know, one of the things I think that it's important to stress for people, you know, for so long, this whole question of the roots of sexual orientation has had this hangover from from Sigmund Freud, you know, who 80 years ago speculated that overprotective mothers and distant fathers made people gay. And like so much about Freud's theory, this one turned out to, you know, be widely believed, persistently believed, and absolute nonsense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what makes people gay, lesbian, the latest science on nature, nurture, biology, psychology, fluidity, big word these days in research circles and beyond. Neil Swidey is with us from the Boston Globe, wrote a piece 10 years ago about this, one of the most read pieces ever online for the newspaper. People just kept reading it year after year. He's come back to look at the latest research, and we'll talk with a couple of the researchers who are at the heart of that ongoing work. Of course, it's been a huge decade for gay rights and the whole position of gay, lesbian, LGBT Americans. Of course, one of the big trends has been fluidity. The other has been many people just know. Here's Susie Orman, the financial guru on TV, telling Oprah back in 2011, she just knew.
I've been gay my whole life. I've never had any desire to be with a man. Mm-hmm. So I knew from a very young age that I liked women. I knew that's how it was. That doesn't mean that it was easy for me. It wasn't, because remember, I am 60 years of age. Yeah. And so way back then, it was not okay to be gay. But I knew it straight away.
But she just knew. For others, maybe more fluid. Here's New York Times columnist Charles Blow talking with Terry Gross on Fresh Air last year.
It's not binary, and that it's a spectrum and not a hierarchy, and that some people are fixed along the spectrum, and some people like me are fluid along the spectrum. There can be moments in your life where you may feel attracted to someone, depending on circumstance, depending on the person, of one gender or another, and sometimes where that is less of an influence in your life.
We'll look at that whole dynamic of fluidity in this hour. Lots of response online. Eric says, I don't know why I'm gay. I just know that I am. Michael says, ultimately, you have to ask, does it really matter? Rachel says, yes, it does, because demonstrating its biological undermines a rationalization for discrimination or blame or shaming. There are politics around this, and they may go to the very beginnings, the origin. Neil, talk to us about a few things. You talked about hormones and the womb. You talk about in your piece, Birth Order and Brothers. What's that about?
So this is one of the areas of sex orientation research that's gotten only stronger and more robust over the last decade, as it's been replicated numerous times cross-culturally over time. And that is that there is this phenomenon where the more older brothers a man has, the more likely he is to be gay. Now that
the more older brothers a man, a male, has, the more likely to be gay. Okay, why?
Yeah. So that's been the big question on it. First, that the it's solid on the science of it, or that it actually is happening on there. But again, you know, if you look at, you know, if a man with no older brothers has a 2% chance of being gay, then that would scale up to 6% if he's got four older brothers. So, you know, it's not, you know, that
this is automatic. So small likelihood, but nevertheless, a clear distinction.
And so there's been this theory, these Canadian researchers have had a hypothesis of maternal immune hypothesis, suggesting that this, you know, the pregnant mother develops this immune response to having a male fetus, and that the more male she has on it, the stronger that gets on here. But it's been a hypothesis without a mechanism. And one of the things I saw this year at this conference I attended in Canada was that they're now studying actual targets on the Y chromosome, male-specific substances on the Y chromosome, to look at this that would actually substantiate this hypothesis. So that's something that's in, because we know this fraternal birth order effect is solid and robust, to find a mechanism actually is causing some excitement within the field.
You also write about finger length in here, different relative finger lengths on the hand. Now, this I would not have come to, and as soon as you begin to describe it, everybody will be looking at their hands.
But everyone does.
It just seems too simple or something. But what's that about?
So this is fascinating because, as you say, there's a normal human reaction to do this. And when I was at this conference, I turned next to me, and there was this very credentialed grad student focusing on epigenetics at the cutting edge, and he did the same thing as one researcher was talking about, this finger length phenomenon, is you put your hand up and see how you fall on it. It doesn't work that simply, and it doesn't work in individuals who are talking.
But what is it? What are people looking for?
Most males will have a, if you hold up your hand, your ring finger will be longer than your index finger. Most females, it's closer. Those are closer in length. Lesbians, the length has more of a male pattern where they're...
With the pointer finger, index finger would be a little perhaps shorter than the ring finger.
Than your ring finger. Again, that doesn't determine it and doesn't mean in every person that that's happening on there. And it really hasn't held up over the last decade in gay men to look at it from the opposite direction. But those finger lengths are set in utero, and those have to do with what's going on with male sex hormone exposure, testosterone and others, androgen exposure, that those things are related. And that's how they know things are happening on there. There's another thing with sort of clicks in your ear that you can't even detect that are stronger in women than in men, but that there's been that lesbians have a closer to male factor on there. And so they you know, those have always been kind of clues, and some have gotten stronger and some have gotten a little cloudier. The finger length one has gotten cloudier over the last decade, particularly in men, but has remained fairly strong in females.
We'll ask the scientists why that might be. I want to bring them in. We've got a lot of callers here, though. Let me have a couple first. Barry in Arlington, Massachusetts. Barry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Relatively long time ago, that Gore Vidal once said there are no heterosexuals or homosexuals. There are only heterosexual acts or homosexual acts. He was prescient, I guess.
Definition here, just acts. What about that, Neil? How do you feel about Gore Vidal's aphorism?
Well, I think one thing I wanted to mention based on what you were saying before and whether this matters or not, this whole question on there, and I think A very interesting point is that studies have shown that people who believe that sexual orientation is immutable, that it's sort of inborn, are more likely, far more likely, to support equal rights for gays and lesbians and bisexuals and the LGBT community on there. And so that, even if the science isn't as settled as maybe we would have hoped, that there, the activity and the action of the scientists and the research moving this forward, even incrementally, has had a pretty profound effect on the growth in acceptance and in public policy.
Understanding the scientific origins. Bob in Neenah, Wisconsin. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I love your show. My brother is gay, and we were raised obviously in the same household with much the same experiences. So mm-hmm. I've always had the, basically had the sense from my experience that then it must be something genetic or inborn. And I found the thing about birth order to be very interesting, as well as what your guest is saying about the environment of the womb. And I was wondering, I saw the research regarding twins. I was wondering how the womb environment or something like that could be different for brothers who, were born a couple of years apart or something like that. Just curious as to his thoughts.
What's your difference in age, Bob, with your brother? Who's older and by how much?
I'm older by a couple of years.
And when did you know, or when did he know?
He, very early. He did not come out until quite a bit later, until he was about 30. But he said he knew since the time he was, 9 or 10 years old.
Let me hold that, if I may, because this womb environment is fascinating, and I want to take it to our researchers who will join us in just a second here. But let me hold that question, if I may, and get one more call, then we'll go. Nashville, Susan is calling. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for the topic. Mm-hmm. I have two children, 32 and 33. Both are gay. I have a niece that's gay. I have a cousin who has a daughter that's gay. And I guess with all of the gay in my family, it leans me towards this, the genetic theory, and I never really doubted it. There are times when, as a mother, you think, okay, I have two children, they're both gay, did I do something? Is my womb weird? Now that you're talking about that, but I appreciate it, and I'm wondering, and I think I missed the first part of the show, you may have answered the question, mm-hmm. about the importance of the research to determine scientifically what is going on, and I think I heard you say it helps with public policy and maybe public opinion, whatever. Is that correct?
Well, it seems that it can. I mean, there's historically, been blaming and shaming. But if it's biological, most people are more understanding. Let us go to your question about genetics here, if I may, Susan. I appreciate your call. That's quite an interesting family tree you lay out there. With us right now from Salt Lake City, Utah, Lisa Diamond joins us. She's professor of developmental psychology, health psychology at the University of Utah, author of the book Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. Lisa Diamond, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And with us from London, England, Kazi Rahman is here. Researches the biology of sexual orientation and LGBT mental health. Lecturer there at King's College in London and author of Born Gay, The Psychobiology of Sex Orientation. Kazi Rahman, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
You just heard our caller in Tennessee who has two kids, 32 and 33, both gay, and she's been listening to the talk about the environment of the womb. She says, is my womb weird? I mean, I don't know what weird would mean in this circumstance, but can you help us understand what may go on in the period of gestation that could influence sexual orientation? As Neil Swidey, our reporter, says, to most people, it's kind of a black box.
Sure, yes. Well, we have some evidence to suggest that sex hormones, the amount of male sex hormone versus female sex hormone circulating around in the womb environment plays a role in determining our sexual attractions. So, for example, if we study girls who are born with a condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which results in naturally increased levels of the male sex hormone. These girls show relatively high levels of same-sex attraction, homosexual or lesbian attractions as adults. And the studies on those populations are relatively consistent. We get the same finding from independent laboratories. In the case of males, it's a little bit more complex, as Neil suggested. And the evidence there comes from slightly different cases. So here, if we study genetic males who, either through some kind of accident or being born without penises and then subjected to sex change and raised as girls, if we follow those men up into adulthood, we find that, again, most of them, if not all of them, are attracted to women. So I think that's very strong evidence against any kind of social theory, but also the fact that you can't make a genetic male attracted, sexually attracted, that is, to another male by raising him as a girl, also supports the idea that prenatal hormones operating in the womb environment have a role to play.
We should say that this has, even in recent years, often been done in the circumstance when a baby's born and it doesn't have developed male genitalia, maybe almost nothing. The parents have been widely advised to just go the female path. And you're saying that even those, when grown to adulthood, are likely still to be heterosexual, even if raised as a girl, because they anatomically didn't have evidence of maleness.
Yes, very much so. And even in childhood, they seem to suggest or exhibit male typical behavior, statistically significant male typical behavior throughout childhood. So there are indicators of their later heterosexuality, if you like, even early in their development.
Lisa Diamond in Salt Lake City, can you help us understand what determines the hormones that would be present in the womb and whether or not they would have a particular effect on a gestating male or female?
That's a really important question, because early on there was a lot of research on whether stressful experiences in the mother might actually alter the prenatal hormone environment. And that there was some suggestive evidence for that, but that has really not panned out. The truth is that we don't know. And that is, I think, something that's quite interesting. And so we are able to drill down and determine that there are some effects of sort of atypical levels of androgen exposure. But
androgen, testosterone.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, testosterone is one form mm-hmm. of androgen. There are others. But the reasons for that variation are not known. And one of the potential linkages between the genetic lines of evidence and the neuroendocrine lines of evidence is that there may be genetically based variations that prefigure the differences in the hormone environment. So, you know, right now we can detect that there are some possible effects of the hormone environment, but what causes the variation in the hormone environment, you know, outside of really extreme cases like congenital adrenal hyperplasia or something like that, we really don't know. And I would just mention is that even with the most extreme cases, and the one that's probably been most well studied in women is CAH, or congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is a genetically based disorder in which there's a malfunction in the adrenal glands, so the fetuses are exposed to high levels of prenatal androgens. They're not abnormally high levels for the typical male fetus, but they are abnormally high levels for the female fetus, and it causes things like virilized genitalia.
What does that mean, virilized?
Meaning that the girl baby is born with a clitoris that looks somewhat like a penis.
Okay.
And that the genitals themselves are somewhat male typical. Even for those women, the longitudinal studies that have been conducted have found that although they tend to show more male-typical play behavior, they don't actually end up becoming lesbians at a greater rate than the general population. They do tend to be more likely to be heterosexually identified women with same-sex attractions. So even with the most extreme hormonal variation, we don't make lesbians. We appear to be making heteroflexible women.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what makes people gay, lesbian, the latest science on nature, nurture, biology, psychology, fluidity, the big word lately. Of course, a lot of attention in the last 10 years on gay rights and understandings and perception of that whole political realm. Neil Swidey, reporter with the Boston Globe, looked 10 years ago at where science was on sexual orientation, and he's come back to it after a decade, kind of momentous decade, to see what's been learned, sheerly as a matter of inquiry. Of course, all these inquiries can have political ramifications as well, but it's basic just on the face of it. Interesting, just on the face of it. He's with us today from Hyannis, Massachusetts, and two researchers deep in this. Lisa Diamond from the University of Utah joins us from Salt Lake City, and Kazi Rahman at King's College, lecturer there in London, author of Born Gay, joins us from London in England. Lisa, author of the book Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. We're looking at what's been learned. 10 more years. That's a lot of research. And what more it's put on the table. Henry's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Henry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to share my story. I'm an identical twin. Both my brother and I were both homosexuals. My older sister is a lesbian. And I wanted to have you ask your guests about my older brother. He's straight. He's hyper-masculine. He played football in high school. He's an ex-Marine. My brother and I were both artistic, kind of, you know, on the creative side of things. My dad has twin cousins who are gay. My mom has an aunt who's a lesbian. I remember reading some research about a mother when she first has her first child, her body having a reaction to the Y chromosome and there being some type of hormonal chemical reaction in the womb that maybe could cause, you know, a hypermasculine first child male son, mm-hmm. and then, you know, subsequent homosexual brothers, a lesbian sister. And maybe if they could clarify some information on that.
Happy to. Stick with us, Henry. Kazi Rahman, speak to that birth order, gender, sexual orientation mm-hmm. there as Henry lays it out sure. in his family. What do you hear?
Yes, it's consistent with the so-called Big Brother effect, which Neil has mentioned and described in detail in his article. And the main theory, and it is just a theory, for why that effect occurs is that the maternal immune system, if you like, forms an immune response to accumulating male proteins in the womb. And through some mechanism as yet unknown, this immune response attacks those proteins, if you like, which then leads to what we might call a more female typical pattern of development in the way the brain is wired as the fetus develops.
And this happens with more vigor in subsequent
yes.
pregnancies than in the first, let's say, yeah. pregnancy with a male?
Yeah, the idea would be is it would be almost like a dose-dependent response. So with each male fetus that is carried, the response becomes stronger and stronger. So, you know, by the fifth or the sixth male child, the probability of being gay is raised. I should point out, though, and Neil made this point very, very mm-hmm. clearly, and it's an important one, is when you scale that up to the population level, the effect is relatively small. So as Neil said, your chance... the contribution of this effect to being gay raises to about 6% down up from 2% in the population. In other words, about 1 in 7 gay men may owe their sexual orientation to this so-called Big Brother effect.
And what about clustering in families? We heard our caller Henry say he and his twin brother and also a sister lesbian. Does this sound like coincidence to you or something else?
No, it sounds... very much like what you find in family pedigrees, you know, a whole bunch of traits, personality traits, aptitudes, all of these are partly influenced by genetics. We know we have evidence from independent research groups in twins, for example, that shows that about 25 to 30% of the differences between people in their sexual orientations is down to genetics. So that doesn't surprise me. I think what's really interesting, though, about that research is it means that genetics only explains about a third of the variation in people's sexual orientation. So genes are absolutely not the whole story.
But we heard Neil telling us earlier that the idea of a gay gene is pretty well debunked, and yet you're still looking at a fairly significant genetic basis. If it's somehow holistic or dependent on, you know, scores or hundreds or thousands of genes, how does it emerge?
Good question. So I completely agree with Neil. I hate the phrase the gay gene, and I'm on record for saying that. But there are such things as genes for sexual orientation. And by that, I mean heterosexual, gay, lesbian and bisexual orientations. People often worry that in this field, we only study gay people. And that's not the case in genetics. We look at the spectrum, if you will. So there are genes for sexual orientation. The open questions are, is how those genes, of which there may be many, interact with other factors such as the hormonal environment, with other influences in the environment, say early in the postnatal period, how those interact to affect the wiring of the brain in those regions which determine who we are oriented to, who catches our attention, if you like, when we walk into a room.
We all have different hormonal balances, and those, I guess, change depending on circumstances and maybe over time. Lisa was describing some of what can go on in the womb. Does it matter that sort of, I'm not sure, the baseline hormonal balance that a woman, or the father for that matter, brings to pregnancy in terms of outcome?
It's a good question. The answer is we don't know. It's a huge black box. It could be that there's some pre-existing difference in the hormonal milieu in the parents, or it could be that genes for sexual orientations nudge the fetus down a particular route, down a particular pathway towards a certain sexual orientation, or that genes simply interact with other environmental factors to influence later sexual orientation.
Let's go to David calling from Waynesboro, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have for years wondered if there's been any scientific evidence or studies done linking environmental factors in this topic and other topics as well, specifically when you consider all the estrogen-laced medicines, the psychiatric medicines, the testosterone medicines, the studies of fish that have shown characteristics of both male and female.
You're talking about getting into the water supply and all that, and
yes,
fish
sir.
That are born ambiguous, a lot of attention paid to
yes,
that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And also how that even might affect such things as autism or ADD or ADHD or any number of health factors that seem to be exploding over the last few years. And if there's any specific relation or any studies done linking the water supply to these discussions.
Lisa Diamond, you've looked a lot at the hormonal factors here. What about the environment, David asks?
I should note, I don't personally, the hormonal research is not research the prenatal hormone is not what I research. I do some work on menstrual cycle variation and sort of day-to-day fluctuations in estrogen and testosterone and how they relate to same-sex and other sex desires. But I think the critical thing to keep in mind here is that whatever amount of variation we can explain through hormonal or genetic factors doesn't get us all the way to understanding the actual human experience of same-sex sexuality as it distributes itself in the population and cross-culturally. So even if we were able to, you know, definitively even find a particular genetic marker and as the previous discussion has highlighted, it's never going to be that simple. There would still be a long way to go in terms of understanding why you see incredible diversity of the manifestations of same-sex sexuality in the population. I think it's probably unlikely that changes, environmental changes related to, you know, estrogens, you know, in the environment, mm-hmm. probably not having a huge effect. At least I haven't seen any sort of data to suggest that to be case. But again, hormones and genes are still a relatively small part of the overall puzzle.
Neil Swiney, lots of questions and comments on Lenny, but here's one from Michael on Facebook. He says, as a gay man, I resent that someone feels the need to figure out why I am the way I am. He writes, stop reinforcing the idea that gay people are different. Is that what you're up to here, Neil?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think it's a fair question, but I think it's completely without merit because, as we talked about before, there. I think for someone like that person who posted that comment, it sounds like that would be someone who supports the greater public acceptance and the public policy laws that for equality that are there. And there is a strong and robust connection between the, as we talked about before, the awareness that this is not some kind of sort of a lifestyle choice, but that there's other important things that are undergirding this that happen, and that is the matter of how it works. The public acceptance has grown with people appreciating the connection and the kind of inborn connections to this and the strength of that. Although there's still a lot that still has to be determined, that has, I think, is a pretty strong connection on there. And one other thing is just that, you know, this is if we could have a headline as Kazi had said before, it would be what makes people gay, straight, bisexual. You know, it's the human dimension, mm-hmm. the whole complexion that we're looking at on there. It's not singling out. Just one population.
Mm-hmm. Although your headline does.
Tom wanted to,
Lisa, yeah.
Tom, could I break in a little
yes.
bit?
Yes.
This issue of belief in inborn origins as being related to public acceptance. It's absolutely true that there's a general correlation that individuals who are more accepting of gay people tend to report believing that it is that people are born that way. We all, you know, we speaking as the culture, mm-hmm. tend to assume that the direction of causation is that individuals who believe that it's inborn are therefore more accepting. There's actually been a lot of intriguing research by a colleague of mine, Peter Hegarty, mm-hmm. who's found that that's not necessarily the case. He's shown that actually individuals start to believe that it is inborn the more accepting that they are. So I actually disagree with the notion that one of the important reasons for doing research on the origins is that people will be more accepting if they understand the biological origins. I don't think that's necessarily true.
So what's your motivation as a scientist, Lisa?
Well, for me, the motivation is just the pure science. I think it's probably one of the most interesting questions, you know, everyone chooses what mm-hmm. they're interested in. I think it's a fascinating question. I think the amount of stuff that we don't know about it is thrilling and intriguing as a scientist. But I am very uncomfortable by the notion that, if we can prove that it is inborn, then society will become more accepting. I think, I'm a political progressive and I'm a lesbian. I think that it should be, you know, more accepted. But I would rather see society become more accepting because as a society, we decide that we believe in sexual autonomy and freedom. I don't think that the the born that way argument is the correct basis on which to advocate for LGBT rights and acceptance. And in fact, there's been a lot of really nice legal scholarship coming out by a colleague of mine at Utah, Cliff Roski, showing that actually the notion that sexual orientation is immutable isn't really the basis on which courts have become more hospitable to same-sex marriage and other rights. So I would like us to treat the question of origins as a separate scientific question and not as a route to LGBT equality.
Autonomy, the word there.
Can I just pop
Neil?
In on that, mm-hmm. Tom? And I I agree with Lisa on that point that it shouldn't be the reason for being. This is a profound human difference that we should be studying. You know, it is not, as critics say, it's not curing cancer to research this, but there's lots of things that aren't curing cancer that are important understanding for who we are as humans. And this is a salient, profound difference that's persisted over time. I will say, though, to Lisa's point, and she knows this, that Anthony Kennedy in his Supreme Court decision, fascinating, just accepts as a fact, almost in a dismissive way, saying that sexual orientation is immutable, and then moves on, and critically does not hang his legal reasoning on that. But it's important, and I think that probably gives us some kind of key. If a conservative justice leading a majority on the Supreme Court is accepting it as a fact, and I think there's some indication there, and it's a strong indication that has had some kind of strong correlation with where we're going as a society.
Immutable, the word there. But Kazi Rahman, the other big word that come up at the top, and we've scarcely time to get to it here, though, is fluidity, the idea that, well, maybe immutable is not what we're talking about, but rather a kind of room to roam.
Yes, fluidity is the buzzword now. I mean, I think is the next buzzword after digital, nano, and quantum. So, you know, and as a Brit, I'm naturally skeptical by my biology, I suppose. What I would say is I'm unclear about the data on sexual fluidity. I don't really buy data that relies on self-selected and convenient samples who are self-reporting on their identities and their sexual behaviors.
But those are not the only
data
we have available now anymore.
Right, but it seems like we do. We don't really have any random population level or longitudinal data on these populations.
Yes, we do.
They're self-selected. So you're saying we have random samples?
Kazi, you were at the meeting. That was the subject of my entire talk.
I wasn't actually at the meeting. But.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were at the meeting.
Missed the meeting. Utah said yes, London says maybe not. You know,
there is random representative data showing fluidity across every major longitudinal representative survey that's been conducted.
Alas, we don't have time to nail that one down today. We can see certainly in the American conversation a lot of focus on fluidity now. Neil Swarty, it sounds as though there may be room for you to come back in another 5 or 10 years and look at this again. I'm grateful for you doing it and spending the time with us today, Neil, with the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Tom.
Neil Swidey, author of What Makes People Gay, an update. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Lisa Diamond, University of Utah, Sexual Fluidity. Thank you, Lisa.
My pleasure.
And Kazi Rahman, author of Born Gay. Thanks for joining us from London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.